Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 18th, Thursday, reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles: Kruger Rock Fire, Planes Pilot, a Military Veteran, by Sam Tabachnik and Noel Phillips; Real Estate, Property Investors Buy Record Shares of Homes in Denver Area, by Aldo Svaldi; Defamation Claims, DPS Board Member Sues Over Assault Allegations, by Shelley Bradbury and Noel Phillips; COVID-19 in Colorado, State's Hospitalizations Jump Again, by Meg Wingerder, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Kruger Rock Fire, Planes Pilot, a Military Veteran. Aviator using novel technique on fire had reported turbulence moments before crash, by Sam Tabachnik and Noel Phillips, The Denver Post. An Army and Air Force veteran pilot using a novel nighttime technique for fighting the Kruger Rock fire in Larimer County on Tuesday reported turbulent conditions as he readied a second drop over the flames, only for his plane to crash moments later. The Larimer County Sheriff's Office said Wednesday afternoon. Mark Thor Olson, a pilot for Colorado Fire Aviation, a Fort Morgan company that fights fires from the air, was called in to conduct aerial drops over the flames, which sparked early Tuesday after high winds blew a tree onto a power line, quickly burning up a steep mountainside as the wind helped it spread near Estes Park. Olson reported that the wind was not too bad at the fire after making a successful water drop Tuesday afternoon, the sheriff's office said. He returned to Loveland to pick up a load of suppressant to make a second drop. About an hour later, the plane returned to the fire, and the pilot told ground resources it was turbulent over the fire. Conditions were not ideal to make a drop, and that he was going to make one more pass and then return to Loveland, the sheriff's office said. Moments later, at approximately 6:37 p.m., ground resources heard the plane crash. Investigators found the wreckage about 3 hours later at the south end of Hermit Park, and Olson's body was recovered Wednesday morning. Olson served in the Army and Air Force for 32 years, and he had 42 years of flying experience, Colorado Fire Aviation said in a statement Wednesday. The veteran pilot logged more than 8,000 flight hours, including 1,000 hours using night vision goggles during combat and civilian air missions. There was no aerial supervision or lead plane required for the mission, and weather and wind conditions were reported to be within limits of our company standard operating procedures, company representatives added in the statement. The cause is being investigated, and nothing has been ruled out at this stage. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating what caused the fatal crash. Colorado Fire Aviation said it is working with the various regulatory agencies involved in the investigation. As of Wednesday evening, the fire stood at 145 acres with 40% containment, according to the U.S. Forest Service. The aircraft used in Tuesday's flight was contracted by Larimer County, and the Kruger Rock Fire was the company's first firefighting mission for the agency, a Colorado Fire Aviation official said in an email. Larimer County officials reached out to Colorado Fire Aviation around midday Tuesday after determining that the best chance of getting ahead of the fire was with the use of airdrops from aviation resources, the sheriff's office said in the news release. The county and company had entered into a call when needed contract in October. The Kruger Rock plane crash is the third fatal air disaster related to firefighting in Estes Park. During the 2002 Big Elk fire, two air tanker pilots, Rick Schwartz of All Montana and Milt Stalick of Cathedral City, California, died July 18th when their plane crashed while hauling slurry to pour on the fire. And helicopter pilot Gordon Knight died on July 30th when his Llama helicopter crashed. Nighttime aerial firefighting is relatively new, with helicopters first deploying to battle fires at night in Australia during the 2019-20 season, according to a March 2020 article in Aerial Fire magazine. Earlier on Tuesday, Nine News interviewed the airplane's crew before it took off to fight the fire. A pilot told the TV station that the flight would be the first time a fixed-wing plane outfitted with night vision equipment would be deployed to fight a wildfire at night. The plane would be carrying a fire suppressant to dump on the flames, the pilot said. Colorado has been exploring this avenue as fires have gotten bigger, faster, and more explosive with a warming climate. A 2018 State Forest Service report found about half the state's population lived in danger of wildfires, a 50% increase from 2012 to 2017. Based on these changing demographics and the fact that in 2018, more than 450 homes were destroyed or damaged in wildfires across Colorado, the Division of Fire Prevention and Control feels there is a need to have the ability to fly fire suppression missions at night, a 2019 state report stated. The state's trials with nighttime helicopters proved successful, and they were used for the first time in September on the Virginia Dale Fire in Larimer County. Colorado fire officials did not, however, do research into nighttime fixed-wing firefighting, the type used Tuesday night in Larimer County. There's been a lack of resources and bandwidth to do those, said Ben Miller, director of Colorado Center of Excellence for Advanced Technology Aerial Firefighting. That's on our radar and continues to be of interest. Even with the lack of research, Miller said he didn't want to suggest we see shortcomings from safety risks. We just haven't gotten there yet. Colorado Fire Aviation, which was founded by Chris Doyle and Kyle Scott, tested night aerial firefighting in 2018 with the Oregon Department of Forestry, after shelving the idea in 2010 because there was a lack of pilots with experience flying low-altitude operations while using night vision goggles, according to the article. Olson led the company's night vision operations and designed training and selected equipment for the company. After several test runs, the company's pilots reported that fighting fires from above while wearing night vision goggles helped them see the fire's hotspots even better than in daylight. And Olson told Aerial Fire that firefighters on the ground wore special headlamps and that he could see them clearly from the air. Neil Lago, aviation manager for the Oregon Department of Forestry, said the trials proved that the fixed-wing tanker approach to nighttime firefighting could be effective. We were at the point where if we got the right fire, we were going to send in the air tanker at night, he said, adding that Oregon never got a fire that fit the criteria for those planes. Lagel will be cautiously waiting to see the NTSB's findings from this crash before deciding whether to use these planes during the next fire season. Real estate. Property investors buy record share of homes in Denver area, by Aldo Spaldi, the Denver Post. Investors are snapping up homes at an unprecedented pace across the country, including in Metro Denver, resulting in more competition for individual buyers trying to find a place of their own in an undersupplied market. Investors purchased a record 18.2% of the homes sold nationally in the third quarter, or 90,215 homes worth $63.6 billion, according to a study from the Seattle-based real estate brokerage Redfin. That is up significantly from 50,051 homes, representing 11.2% of all sales that investors claimed in the third quarter of 2020, and above pre-pandemic levels, including during the housing bust, when investors actively scooped up foreclosures. More than 3 in 10 homes purchased in Atlanta and Charlotte, North Carolina, went to investors in the third quarter. Metro Denver tracked closer to the national averages, with investors accounting for 17% of home sales, up from their 9% market share in the same quarter a year earlier. That represents 2,831 homes of the 16,811 sold during the most recent quarter, up from 1,646 homes of the 17,577 sold in the third quarter of 2020, according to the study. Investors are expecting rents to increase in the coming years, said Redfin chief economist Daryl Fairweather. Even though home prices are high, they are waiting for rents to grow, and there are no signs that prices will decline. Not only are investors buying more single-family homes than they historically have, but their purchases also are skewing more toward mid-priced and higher-end homes rather than entry-level homes, which have gone from a majority of investor purchases to a little more than a third, Redfin's research shows. In Denver, the median price investors paid for a home was $508,700, according to Redfin. Redfin defines an investor as a business entity used to purchase a residential property. That definition excludes individual buyers who purchase investment properties in their own names, but it also lumps some buyers into the investor category who purchase a home to live in through an LLC or trust. Overall, the range of investors is broad, from retirees buying a house on the same block to private equity funds with billions of dollars to deploy. Troy Miller, executive director of the Investment Community of the Rockies, or ICOR, estimates 5 to 7 institutional buyers are active in the Denver market. Most of the remainder are seasoned investors, not the kind of novices who jumped into a glutted and peaking housing market in the middle of the 2000s and paid dearly for it. Activity is very high because institutional buyers are chasing yield and are borrowing at close to nothing. One ICOR member works sourcing deals directly for one institutional buyer with the expectation of acquiring 40 properties per quarter, he said in an email. Plenty of available capital and diminishing competition has seasoned investors willing to take on even higher priced homes in the $500,000 to $700,000 range, he said. The margins are smaller, but if redeveloped properly, the returns can be in the $100,000 to $200,000 range. Seasoned investors are simply adapting to new market variables, he said. Andrew Abrams, chairman of the Market Trends Committee at the Denver Metro Association of Realtors and a Denver area real estate agent, said he has worked with clients wanting to pick up a second or third home to boost their income up to an active investor with 300 townhomes in his portfolio. From my conversations with them recently, they believe that the value of the dollar is decreasing every day and that interest rates are historically low. To invest in an actual asset that has limited supply will help them leverage against a weaker dollar, he said. In short, real estate offers a way to hedge against inflation and represents an asset class they have more control over than stocks or bonds. Investors can borrow money at around 2.5%, he said. And even if home price gains revert back to the 30-year average of around 6% a year, they will come out ahead. Should home prices dip, say because inflation causes mortgage rates to spike, investors are better equipped to ride it out. An investor who puts 30% to 40% down on a purchase has a much bigger cushion than a first-time buyer who puts 3% or 5% down, he said. More broadly, there is also a sense that higher home prices will prevent more households from buying a place, creating stronger demand for single-family rentals for years to come. higher home prices are a risk, but they are also a hedge ensuring more rental demand. The current surge of investor interest comes after home prices have risen at unprecedented double-digit annual gains for several months. CoreLogic estimates that Metro Denver home prices are up 19% year over year as of September. Next year, it estimates gains will average only 0.4%. It feels like we are at an inflection point. Eli Baracha, a real estate professor at Florida International University, which together with Florida Atlantic University maintains an index of expected home price changes, said in a release. When precisely any given housing market will peak is hard to tell, Baracha said. But he recommends individual buyers in the country's most overpriced markets, which includes Metro Denver, consider renting and reinvesting any savings. Put another way, his advice is to let investors have at it. You don't want to be among the last to buy at your local market's peak, because it may be a long time before you can resell your property for a substantial return, he said. Abrams said first-time buyers should pursue property types where investors are less active right now, such as condos and townhomes, and they should try to strike a chord with sellers who might have been in a similar situation to them decades earlier. Telling your story helps buyers compete, he said. Most people have put so much love and memories into their home, they want to pass it on to someone else who will fill those wells in the same way. Owning a home is the primary way Americans accumulate wealth. Ownership can provide for a more stable retirement, and a home is a resource that can be passed down to children and other heirs. Because of that, the growing dominance of investors has bigger implications for the country, Fairweather said. Fundamentally, we will need to see strong wage growth for the middle class to take back home ownership from investors, she said. Defamation claims. DPS board member sues over assault allegations by Shelley Bradbury and Noelle Phillips, The Denver Post. Denver school board member Tay Anderson filed a defamation lawsuit Wednesday against local nonprofit Black Lives Matter 5280. Its leadership, and two other people who accused him of perpetrating sexual assault. Claims an independent investigation found to be unsubstantiated. The lawsuit filed in Denver District Court is the latest development into an eight-month saga that began in March when Black Lives Matter 5280 claimed in a written statement on social media that a woman who wished to remain anonymous had approached the organization and accused Anderson of sexually assaulting her. The allegation and others that followed eventually led Denver Public Schools to commission an independent investigation into Anderson's behavior. In September, the investigators issued a report saying they could not substantiate any of the sexual assault allegations against Anderson. They did, however, say they discovered that Anderson had flirted online with a 16-year-old student and penned coercive social media posts, behavior that the school board deemed unbecoming of a board member. Denver Public Schools Board of Education Board subsequently censured Anderson. Armed with no evidence, no victims, no witnesses, and only baseless accusations conjured from their own twisted minds, defendants laid siege to Anderson's life and reputation, such that within months, the once sanguine and energetic young Anderson shrank into a dejected, listless version of himself, struggling against the impulse to end his own life, the lawsuit reads. In addition to Black Lives Matter 5280 and its leadership, Anderson also names DPS parent Mary Catherine Brooks Fleming as a defendant in the lawsuit. Brooks Fleming testified before a state legislative committee in May that she was aware of 62 students who had been sexually assaulted, raped, or subjected to sexual misconduct by Anderson, although she did not name him in her speech at the time. The school board later said Brooks Fleming had been referring to Anderson. The school district's independent investigation found Brooks Fleming's claims to be objectively implausible on their face. Anderson did not return a request for comment Wednesday, and his attorney, Issa Israel, declined to comment. I did not come to this decision lightly, and it pains me to once again bring attention to this traumatic experience, but I'm a victim of false allegations that almost took my life, Anderson said on Twitter. In the lawsuit, Anderson alleges he suffered more than $1 million in damages and alleges that leaders at Black Lives Matter 5280 put out false information about him because they didn't want to share the proverbial spotlight with him in activism circles. Representatives for Black Lives Matter 5280 and defendants April Alexander, Amy Brown, Ari Lipscomb, and Michael Diaz-Rivera, identified in the lawsuit as BLM 5280 leadership, did not return requests for comment Wednesday. Brooks Fleming did not return a request for comment. Defendant Jeeva Senthilnathan's attorney, Ruchi Kapoor, said Wednesday she had not spoken to her client about the lawsuit and declined to comment. Senthilnathan is a college student who has unsuccessfully run for Parker Town Council and is active in social justice causes. In October, she posted a lengthy Facebook video and statement in which she talked about Anderson's treatment of women. She later said Anderson's lawyer had sent her a cease and desist letter and threatened to sue her. Senthilnathan then posted her own lawyer's letter in response that said his threats of a lawsuit were meritless and only an attempt to chill free speech. Because you remain a publicly elected official, despite the school board's vote to censure you in September 2021, the burden remains on you to prove actual damages resulting from Ms. Senthilnathan's statement, Kapoor wrote at the time. COVID-19 in Colorado. State's hospitalizations jump again. Virus's statewide death toll surpasses 9,000, by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Colorado's weekend decline in COVID-19 hospitalizations didn't last, with nearly 100 more people hospitalized on Wednesday than on Monday. The continued growth in hospitalizations pointed to more loss ahead, even as Colorado crossed 9,000 COVID-19 deaths on Wednesday. Deaths have climbed steadily in recent weeks, with more than 200 reported in the first week of November, the most since the week ending January 3rd. I wish I had better news to report on the hospitalization front, Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander, said on a press call Wednesday, before announcing 1,526 people were receiving hospital care for the virus. The last time Colorado saw more people hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19 was December 11th. Hospitalizations had dropped from 1,476 on Friday to 1,431 on Monday, before losing much of that ground again Tuesday. More than 80% of people currently hospitalized for COVID-19 aren't fully vaccinated. The fall 2020 wave had peaked on December 1st, when 1,847 people were hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19. Projections show Colorado could exceed that level and possibly run out of hospital beds by the end of December. We still seem to be heading very much in that direction, Bookman said. As of Wednesday afternoon, 566 general hospital beds and 69 intensive care beds were available statewide. More than one-third of hospitals reporting to the state anticipated staffing shortages in the coming week. New COVID-19 cases appear to have somewhat leveled out in the last week, but it's likely at least part of that change came from delays in data reporting, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said. The percentage of tests coming back positive also dropped slightly, though it's still nearly double the state's 5% goal. The overall trajectory continues to be an upward trajectory, she said. Outbreaks also went up this week, rising by about 12%, according to data from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. As of Wednesday, the state reported 724 active outbreaks, which are defined as five or more cases linked to a common location or event. Long-term care facilities are an exception, and must report an outbreak after 2 cases. The most common outbreak locations were K-12 schools, 282 outbreaks, nursing homes, 98, assisted living facilities, 86, prisons, jails, and other correctional facilities, 37, child care centers, 37. Unvaccinated people are about 4 times more likely to test positive than fully vaccinated people, Herlihy said. After adjusting for age differences between the vaccinated and unvaccinated populations, those who haven't completed their primary shot series are about 10 times as likely to be hospitalized and 14 times as likely to die, she said. Spread of the virus continues to be highest in children between 5 and 11, the group that recently became eligible for the Pfizer vaccine, followed by the adult population, Herlihy said. The youngest children continue to have the lowest rates of new cases. Nationwide, cases are rising again after dropping throughout October, and hospitalizations have stabilized at about 47,000 after falling for weeks. Deaths, which lag behind hospitalizations by at least 2 weeks, are still falling nationally. Colorado added 49 new deaths on Wednesday, bringing the total number of people who have died in the state due to the virus to 9,027. Evidence is growing that immunity wanes in the months after vaccination or infection, so it's a good idea to get a booster shot, Herlihy said. Last week, Colorado became the first state to expand eligibility for boosters to anyone who had their last shot at least 6 months ago. People who received the Johnson & Johnson shot are eligible after only 2 months. Arkansas, California, New Mexico, and New York City have followed suit, and the Food and Drug Administration is expected to expand its booster authorization to all adults as soon as Thursday, according to the New York Times. If the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention concurs, as expected, anyone at least 6 months out from their last shot could get another starting this weekend, regardless of where they live. Since the end of October, Colorado officials ordered a temporary halt to cosmetic surgeries, asked the Federal Emergency Management Agency to send healthcare teams to hotspots, instructed hospitals to take any transferred patient they have the capacity to care for, reactivated crisis standards, guiding how hospitals can stretch their workforces, and expanded access to monoclonal antibody treatments, which reduce the risk of hospitalization from COVID-19. There are no imminent plans to activate the crisis standards of care that would allow hospitals to ration care or to order them to pause a wider range of non-emergency procedures, Bookman said. The state is in talks to bring in 2 more FEMA teams and to recruit additional nurses so hospitals and nursing homes can reopen up to 500 unused beds, he said. Bookman urged anyone who hasn't gotten vaccinated to do so quickly and asked all Coloradans to wear masks in public and limit their close contacts by keeping gatherings small. There is a lot of disease in Colorado right now, he said. This is not going to last forever. 4 locations searched in Mesa County clerk investigation by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. The FBI and state law enforcement officials searched 4 locations in Mesa and Garfield counties Tuesday in connection with a criminal investigation into employees of the Mesa County Clerk's office. Clerk Tina Peters, a Republican, and others in her office have been under criminal investigation over a possible election security breach in August, after voting equipment passwords were posted online by a leading figure in the QAnon conspiracy theory. The district attorney's office and the state attorney general's office assisted the FBI in the operation, which was described by Mesa County spokesperson Stephanie Reese as federally authorized law enforcement actions into potential criminal activity by employees of the Mesa County Clerk and Recorder's Office and others associated with those employees. No arrests were made, and the operations are related to ongoing investigations. Per order of a federal court, All documents related to these operations are sealed, Reese said in an email. In August, search warrants were executed on the Mesa County Elections Office and cell phones used by Peters. The activity Tuesday morning garnered attention after an appearance by Peters on Lindell TV, an online show run by Mike Lindell, CEO of MyPillow, and a 2020 election conspiracy theorist who arranged Peters' lodging when she was out of the state in August. Peters said the FBI raided her home at 6 a.m., according to Colorado Politics, and those of some of her friends. "I was terrified," she said. On his show, Lindell said one of the homes searched in Garfield County belonged to Sharona Bishop, a former campaign manager for U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert, Colorado Politics reported. A consultant for Peters' legal defense, Rory McShane, said in a written statement that large teams of heavily armed federal agents using a battering ram to break down doors raided the homes of Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters and several of her friends and colleagues, mostly elderly women in their mid-60s. He called it a level of weaponization of the Justice Department that we haven't seen since the McCarthy era. But State Attorney General Phil Weiser and Mesa County District Attorney Dan Rubenstein released a statement late Wednesday that refuted those claims, saying, "At no time was force used on Ms. Peters or her home. Ms. Peters was allowed to move around her home and fix herself breakfast while agents gathered items before departing." Peters and Deputy Clerk Belinda Nisley also have been the subject of civil actions. After the Colorado Secretary of State's office filed a lawsuit in August, a judge barred them both from overseeing the November 3rd election. Peters also faces a lawsuit alleging campaign finance and election official contribution violations. The controversial clerk has become an advocate for those who make claims without evidence of widespread fraud in the 2020 election. She filed counterclaims to the Secretary of State's lawsuit, alleging the deletion of election records. On Tuesday, the Colorado Independent Ethics Commission ruled a complaint against Peters related to her acceptance and solicitation of contributions in her official capacity was non-frivolous and could move forward. House censures Gosar for violent video in Rare Rebuke by Kevin Freiking and Brian Sladisco, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. The House voted Wednesday to censure Republican Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona for posting an animated video that depicted him killing Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with a sword, an extraordinary rebuke that highlighted the political strains testing Washington and the country. Calling the video a clear threat to a lawmaker's life, Democrats argued Gosar's conduct would not be tolerated in any other workplace and shouldn't be in Congress. The vote to censure Gosar and also remove him from his House committee assignments was approved by a vote of 223-207, almost entirely along party lines, with Representatives Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois the only Republicans voting in favor. Gosar had deleted the tweet days ago amid the criticism, but he retweeted the video late Wednesday shortly after the vote. Gosar showed no emotion as he stood in the well of the House after the vote, flanked by about a dozen Republicans, as Speaker Nancy Pelosi read the censure resolution and announced his committee penalty. He shook hands, hugged, and patted other members of the GOP conference on the back before leaving the chamber. Republican Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy called the vote an abuse of power by Democrats to distract from national problems. He said of the censure, "A new standard will continue to be applied in the future, a sign of potential ramifications for Democratic members should Republicans retake a majority." But Democrats said there was nothing political about it. "These actions demand a response. We cannot have members joking about murdering each other," Pelosi said. "This is both an endangerment of our elected officials and an insult to the institution." Ocasio-Cortez herself said in an impassioned speech, When we incite violence with depictions against our colleagues, that trickles down to violence in this country. And that is where we must draw the line. Unrepentant during tense floor debate, Gosar rejected what he called the mischaracterization that the cartoon was dangerous or threatening. It was not. I do not espouse violence towards anyone. I never have. It was not my purpose to make anyone upset, Gosar said. He compared himself to Alexander Hamilton, the nation's first Treasury Secretary, celebrated in recent years in the Broadway musical, whose censure vote in the House was defeated. If I must join Alexander Hamilton, the first person attempted to be censured by this House, so be it. It is done. The decision to censure Gosar, one of the strongest punishments the House can dole out, was just the fourth in nearly 40 years, and just the latest example of the raw tensions that have roiled Congress since the 2020 election and the violent Capitol insurrection that followed. Democrats spoke not only of the deadly January 6th insurrection, but also the violent attacks that have escalated on both parties, including the 2017 shooting of Republican lawmakers practicing for a congressional baseball game and the 2011 shooting of former Arizona Representative Gabby Giffords as she met with constituents at an event outside a Tucson grocery store. Republicans largely dismissed Gosar's video as nothing more than a cartoon, a routine form of political expression, and hardly the most important issue facing Congress. Yet, threats against lawmakers are higher than ever, the chief of the U.S. Capitol Police said this year. The censure of Gosar was born out of Democratic frustration. In the past week, as outrage over the video grew, House GOP leaders declined to publicly rebuke Gosar, who has a lengthy history of incendiary remarks. Instead, they largely ignored his actions and urged their members to vote against the resolution censuring him. Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida said, "I would just suggest we have better things to do on the floor of the House of Representatives than be the hall monitors for Twitter." The resolution will remove Gosar from two committees, Natural Resources and the Oversight and Reform Panel, on which Ocasio-Cortez also serves, limiting his ability to shape legislation and deliver for constituents. It states that depictions of violence can foment actual violence and jeopardize the safety of elected officials. January 6th rioter who carried spear, wore horns, draws 41 months. Jacob Chansley, the spear-carrying January 6th rioter, whose horned fur hat, bare chest, and face paint made him one of the more recognizable figures in the assault on the Capitol, was sentenced Wednesday to 41 months in prison. Chansley, who pleaded guilty to a felony charge of obstructing an official proceeding, was among the first rioters to enter the building. He has acknowledged using a bullhorn to rile up the mob, offering thanks and a prayer while in the Senate, for having the chance to get rid of traitors and scratching out a threatening note to Vice President Mike Pence saying, "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming." Although he isn't accused of violence, prosecutors say Chansley of Arizona was the public face of the Capitol riot, who went into the attack with a weapon, ignored repeated police orders to leave the building, and gloated about his actions in the days after the attack. Before he was sentenced, Chansley told U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth it was wrong for him to enter the Capitol and that he accepts responsibility for his actions. He emphasized he wasn't an insurrectionist and is troubled with the way he was portrayed in news stories in the aftermath of the riot. "I have no excuse," Chansley said. "No excuses whatsoever. My behavior is indefensible." The judge said Chansley's remorse appeared to be genuine, but noted the seriousness of his actions in the Capitol. "What you did was terrible," Lambert said. "You made yourself the center of the riot." The image of Chansley holding a flagpole topped with a spear tip and looking as if he were howling was one of the most striking to emerge from the riot. He previously called himself the QAnon shaman, but has since repudiated the QAnon movement. This is from the Associated Press. In news briefs, Bishops avoid confrontation with Biden over communion. Byline, Baltimore. The Roman Catholic bishops of the United States backed away from a direct conflict with President Joe Biden on Wednesday, approving a new document on the sacrament of the Eucharist that does not mention the president or any politicians by name. At issue was the question of which Catholics, under which circumstances, are properly able to receive communion, one of the most sacred rites within Christianity. For some conservative Catholics, the real question was more pointed. Should Catholic politicians who publicly support and advance abortion rights be denied the sacrament? Although the document shied away from explicitly challenging Biden, its very existence highlighted a divide between conservative American bishops and the Vatican. Belarus brings some migrants in from the cold at Polish border. Byline, Warsaw, Poland. Hundreds of migrants who were camped in the cold on the Poland-Belarus border have been moved to a nearby warehouse in Belarusian territory, report said Wednesday, with some still harboring hopes of entering the European Union. The move came a day after a melee broke out in the border crisis, with migrants throwing stones at Polish forces massed on their side of the razor wire fence, injuring 12. Polish forces responded with water cannons and tear gas. Warsaw accused Belarusian forces of instigating the conflict, while the government in Minsk denounced Poland's violent actions. Idaho lawmaker is censured for disclosing data of intern who reported rape. An Idaho lawmaker who shared the personal information of a 19-year-old student intern online after the teenager accused another lawmaker of rape was censured by the Idaho House of Representatives on Monday. The representative, Priscilla Giddings, a Republican from Whitebird, was stripped of a committee assignment because she had shared an article that included the intern's personal details on Facebook and in a newsletter with her supporters. Giddings, who is seeking the Republican nomination for lieutenant governor, shared the information after the intern in March accused Representative Aaron von Ehlinger of sexual assault. Liverpool bomber had planned for months, UK police say. Byline, London. The man who set off an explosive device in a taxi outside a Liverpool hospital Sunday had been buying components for the device for months and had a history of mental illness, police said Wednesday. Police have said they believe the man, who was the only person killed in the blast, was a 32-year-old named Imad al-Suilmin. According to the police, he was originally from Iraq, but authorities have said they are still trying to understand the motivation for the attack in the northern English city, which is being treated as an act of terrorism. Rapper killed at cookie shop. Byline, Memphis, Tennessee. Rapper Young Dolph, widely admired in hip-hop for his authenticity and fierce independence, was shot and killed Wednesday at a cookie shop in his hometown of Memphis, authorities said. Police tweeted, it did not release any information about a suspect in the shooting at Makeda's Cookies near Memphis International Airport. The Daily Memphian newspaper reported that Young Dolph's cousin, Moreno Myers, said the 36-year-old rapper had been in town since Monday, visiting an aunt who has cancer and was giving out Thanksgiving turkeys. These briefs were from Denver Post Wire Services. Two men set to be cleared in 1965 killing of Malcolm X by Jennifer Peltz, the Associated Press, Byline, New York. Two of the three men convicted in the assassination of Malcolm X are set to be cleared Thursday after insisting on their innocence since the 1965 killing of one of the United States' most formidable fighters for civil rights, their lawyers and Manhattan's top prosecutor said Wednesday. A nearly two-year-long reinvestigation found that authorities withheld evidence favorable to the defense in the trial of Muhammad Aziz, now 83, and the late Khalil Islam, said their attorneys, the Innocence Project, and civil rights lawyer David Shaneys. Aziz called his conviction the result of a process that was corrupt to its core, one that is all too familiar, even today. I do not need this court, these prosecutors, or a piece of paper to tell me I am innocent, he said in a statement. But he said he was glad his family, friends, and lawyers could get to see the truth we have all known, officially recognized. He urged the criminal justice system to take responsibility for the immeasurable harm it caused me. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. tweeted that his office would join the men's attorneys in asking a judge Thursday to toss out the convictions. These men did not get the justice that they deserved, Vance told the New York Times, which first reported on the developments. Innocence Project co-founder Barry Scheck called the case one of the most blatant miscarriages of justice that I have ever seen. One of the civil rights era's most controversial and compelling figures, Malcolm X rose to fame as the Nation of Islam's chief spokesperson, proclaiming the Black Muslim organization's message at the time, racial separation as a road to self-actualization. He famously urged Black people to claim civil rights by any means necessary and referred to white people as blue-eyed devils, and he later denounced racism. About a year before his death, he split from the Nation of Islam and later made a pilgrimage to Mecca, returning with a new view of the potential for racial unity. Some in the Nation of Islam saw him as a traitor. At age 39, he was gunned down as he began a speech in Harlem's Audubon Ballroom on February 21, 1965. Aziz Islam and a third man, Mujahid Abdul Halim, also known as Talmadge Hayer and Thomas Hagen, were convicted of murder in March 1966 and sentenced to life in prison. Hagen said he was one of three gunmen who shot Malcolm X, but he testified that neither Aziz nor Islam was involved. The two, then known as Norman 3X Butler and Thomas 15X Johnson, maintained throughout that they were innocent and offered alibis at their 1966 trial. No physical evidence linked them to the crime. Thomas 15 Johnson and Norman 3X Butler had nothing to do with this crime whatsoever, Hagen said in a sworn statement in 1977. Hagen was paroled in 2010. A message was left Wednesday at a phone number he had when paroled. He identified two other men as gunmen, but no one else was ever arrested. According to the New York Times, the reinvestigation found the FBI had documents that pointed to other suspects, and a still living witness supported Aziz's alibi that he was at home with a leg injury at the time of the shooting. The witness, whom authorities had never interviewed before and was identified only by the initials JM, said he spoke to Aziz on the latter's home phone the day of the killing, the newspaper said. Also, the review found that prosecutors knew about but didn't disclose that undercover officers were in the ballroom when the gunfire erupted, and police knew that someone had called the Daily News of New York earlier that day saying that Malcolm X would be killed. The New York Police Department and the FBI said Wednesday that they had cooperated fully with the reinvestigation, and they declined to comment further. Aziz was released in 1985. Islam was released 2 years later and died in 2009. Both continued to press to clear their names. I did not kill Malcolm X, Aziz said at a news conference in 1998, after the Nation of Islam tapped him to run the mosque where the slain leader had preached. A decade later, Islam told a gathering at a Harlem bookstore, I need to be exonerated. I had to walk 22 years in prison. And after their release, he and Aziz lived under a cloud of being Malcolm X's supposed assassins. Exonerating these men is a righteous and well-deserved affirmation of their true character, Shaney said in a statement. Deborah Francois, a counsel in his office, called the convictions the product of gross official misconduct and a criminal justice system weighed against people of color. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office publicly acknowledged it was considering reopening the case after Netflix aired the documentary series Who Killed Malcolm X last year. The series explored a theory by scholars that the two men were innocent and that some of the real killers had escaped. Henry Montgomery, at center of juvenile life debate, is now free, by Rebecca Santana, the Associated Press, byline Baton Rouge, Louisiana. After spending nearly six decades behind bars, the Louisiana inmate whose Supreme Court case was instrumental in extending the possibility of freedom to hundreds of people sentenced to life in prison without the opportunity for parole when they were juveniles was freed on parole Wednesday. Henry Montgomery, 75, was released from prison just hours after the parole board's decision and went to the offices of the Louisiana Parole Project, a nonprofit which is supporting him after his release. There he was embraced by tearful staff and former juvenile lifers who were freed as a result of the court case that bears Montgomery's name. "It feels so wonderful," said Montgomery during an interview with the Associated Press. When asked what he plans to do now that he is out of prison, Montgomery said he wanted to pay his respects to his mother and grandmother and other family members who died when he was behind bars. Montgomery had been convicted in the 1963 killing of East Baton Rouge Sheriff's Deputy Charles Hurt, who caught him skipping school. Montgomery was 17 at the time. He was initially sentenced to death, but the state Supreme Court threw out his conviction in 1966, saying he didn't get a fair trial. The case was retried, Montgomery convicted again, but this time sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He served decades at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. The three-member board voted unanimously in favor of parole. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, the meeting was held on Zoom, with Montgomery appearing on camera at Angola. He's been in prison for 57 years. He has an excellent disciplinary record. He is a low risk by our assessment. He's got good comments from the warden, said board member Tony Mirabella, as he voted to approve Montgomery's release with certain conditions, including a curfew, and that he have no contact with the victim's family. Montgomery's release owes back to two specific Supreme Court cases. In 2012, the Supreme Court ruled in Miller v. Alabama that mandatory sentencing of life without parole for juvenile offenders was cruel and unusual punishment, but it didn't settle the question of whether that decision applied retroactively or only to cases moving forward. In 2016, the Supreme Court settled the matter when it took up Montgomery's case and extended their decision on such sentences to people already in prison. The decision ushered in a wave of new sentences and releases. Since the court's Montgomery decision, about 800 people who had been sentenced to life without parole as juveniles have been released, according to the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. But until Wednesday, Montgomery remained in prison. After the Supreme Court decision, he was resentenced in 2017 to life with parole, and the state judge who resentenced Montgomery called him a model prisoner who appears to be rehabilitated. But then the parole board rejected his application two times, the most recent rejection coming in 2019. Andrew Hundley is a former juvenile lifer who was released due to the Montgomery decision and went on to found the Parole Project in 2016 to assist people who have served long prison sentences reenter society. He said many former juvenile lifers who were released and were able to go on with their lives felt a collective sense of guilt that Montgomery, whose case made their releases possible, was still behind bars. For juvenile lifers still incarcerated, his release carries a different message, Hundley said. For individuals who continue to be in prison, Henry gives them hope that they may be judged by who they are today and not the worst mistake they ever made, Hundley said. The Parole Project will help Montgomery with housing, signing up for health care or medications, getting an ID card, and learning how to navigate society. The re-entry started with a cheeseburger, fries, and an orange soda, his first meal out of prison, and his first cell phone, which staff members said they would help him set up. Sean Williams was on hand Wednesday to welcome Montgomery. He was a former juvenile lifer who served time in Angola with Montgomery. He recalled Montgomery taking a sign language class in prison that Williams taught despite his arthritis, and Montgomery giving him advice in prison to never give up. William said he was holding back tears watching Montgomery on Wednesday. If it wasn't for him, I'd still be in Angola, William said. U.S. offers investment to boost global vaccine capacity, by Zeke Miller, the Associated Press, byline, Washington. Press to address gaping inequality in global COVID-19 vaccines. The Biden administration took steps Wednesday to make billions of dollars available to drug makers to scale up domestic production, to share with the world, and prepare for the next pandemic. Under the new initiative, the government's Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority is soliciting pharmaceutical companies with proven ability to make the more effective mRNA vaccines to bid for U.S. investment in scaling up their manufacturing. Pfizer and Moderna produce the two U.S.-approved mRNA shots. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County want some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
There are children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that vapes and e-cigarettes may not be as safe as you think? It is not harmless water vapor. The aerosol emitted from e-cigarettes is a mix of chemicals that may cause harm to human bodies. This includes nicotine, nanoparticles, heavy metals, and flavorings known to cause respiratory disease. It is not an FDA-approved cessation device. E-cigarettes are not approved for cessation of cigarettes at this time. Only approved nicotine products with counseling have been proven to help people quit all tobacco products for good. E-cigarettes are not regulated. At this time, there are no standard regulations for e-cigarette products. This means that the exact ingredients or how they are made are unknown. Nicotine is present in almost all products. Though some products may claim to be nicotine-free, no regulation means there is no way to show that these claims are true. Also, there are still chemicals in e-liquids that may be harmful to the human body. Nicotine is addictive. Using tobacco products has been considered a nasty habit for too long. The truth is that nicotine in tobacco products is addictive. It can change biology and, if left untreated, can last a lifetime. Nicotine can harm the developing brain. The brain is still developing until about the age of 25. Nicotine can disrupt brain development and cause impulsive behaviors and difficulty focusing. When young people use nicotine, they are susceptible to a lifetime of addiction. Flavors attract kids. Though some adults may enjoy using products flavored like cotton candy or gummy bears, many of the e-liquids are meant to taste like childhood favorites of young people. Big tobacco plays a role. Big tobacco companies who have a history of putting sales above safety own shares of many vape companies. This message was brought to you by the Tri-County Health Department. For more information, please visit tchd.org/e-cigs.
Did you know you can get your localized time and weather forecast by dialing into AINC? No internet is required. Just dial 303-786-7777, extension 5.